What we're saying is go directly to those other rates. Don't have this huge transition through those things. If you think there's a housing bubble in San Francisco, go raise the interest rate on certain mortgages in San Francisco.
Sure.
Right? Go raise the minimum lending terms for loans in San Francisco on particular things, right? That's where we're going with it. And it's because you get problems like we're having right now, and you mentioned it actually early on. You raise the interest rate like this and this fast, it's not just the U.S. economy you're messing up. You are messing with the whole world right now.
Welcome to Activist MMT, a podcast about real-world economics, including modern money theory, and how life changes when you discover it. I'm your host, Jeff Epstein. Today is the final part of my three-part conversation with Scott Fulweiler on his 2008 paper, Modern Central Bank Operations, The General Principles. Today we discuss principles 7 through 10. My full and detailed question and summary list can be found in the show notes to part 1. Also, be sure to check out the list of audio chapters at the bottom of today's show notes to find precisely where each principle and otherwise can be found. Principle 7, which refers to a world without a floor system, QE being an example of a floor system, is that a central bank can change its target interest rate by simply announcing it. This is contrary to the false idea that the central bank can only set a new target rate by overwhelming the system with reserves in order to push the rate higher, or push it lower by starving the system by selling a very large amount of bonds. This implies the central bank and its government to be little more than a very large currency user. Also, the liquidity effect is the false idea that the mere existence of reserves makes banks want more of them, and that this in turn results in more lending to its customers. This is essentially Say's law, which is the false idea that supply causes demand. Principle 8 is that the amount of total reserves in the system is primarily due to the central bank's method of interest rate management. If a central bank chooses a floor system like QE, then there will be a whole lot of reserves in the system. If they also choose restrictive reserve requirements, then there will be even more, as banks demand more in order to meet those requirements. If there was no floor system or reserve requirements, then the total amount in the system will be greatly reduced. In this case, once again, the aggregate level will be controlled by the rigidness of banks needing to settle payments each day, which is primarily dependent on the behavior of actual humans in the real economy, which is the non-government sector. Principles 9 and 10 basically assert that the central bank is in the unique position of being a currency issuer. Only the central bank, via the execution of fiscal policy, can create net financial assets, which is money we don't have to pay back. Commercial banks can only create credit, which must always be paid back plus interest. Commercial banks, and indeed the entire financial system and economy, depends on the central bank because we have to pay taxes, which can ultimately only be paid with reserves, which can only be done through the banking system. Also, banks are legal franchises of the state. If a commercial bank tried to bypass the central banking system entirely, it wouldn't be a bank for long. In the same way, you could try and call yourself a bank, but unless you're legally sanctioned and accepted as one by the central bank, you're not going to get very far. You can financially support this podcast by going to patreon.com/activistmmt. For as little as $1 a month, all patrons get exclusive super early access to several full episodes and some unique patron-only opportunities like asking my academic guests questions, like my episodes with Dirk Entz, John Harvey, and Warren Mosler. In addition to this podcast, patrons also support the development of my large and growing collection of LearnMNT resources and my journey through the Torrens graduate program. To become a patron, you can start by going to patreon.com/activistmmt. Every little bit helps a little bit, and it all adds up to a lot. Thanks. And now, let's get right back to my conversation with Scott Fulweiler. Enjoy.
I don't know exactly. I don't know if that would work. There's a strange thing in the U.S. system where not every entity that has a reserve account earns interest on reserves, and it's those non-banks. It's the government-sponsored enterprises and the Federal Home Loan Bank and things like that. And so you do see the interest rate, the federal funds rate in the U.S. trading below the interest on reserves, because those entities are willing to take lower than interest on reserves to get someone to borrow from them. It's not the same thing as what you're saying, but it's I don't know. I don't know if you set the penalty rate below. I mean, basically, it would be a situation where,
I mean, you're going to go to the penalty window and you're going to buy it. You're going to get it cheaper than IOR, but then you're going to be holding them, which means you're going
to. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it would basically, so there's two ways to look at that. Sorry, I was looking at it one way, and what you just said made me look at it the other way. There are two ways to look at it. One is the way I was looking at it, which was actually the wrong, not the wrong, but the very fringe or you know, tangential way to look at it, which is the Fed pre-2003, which is the Fed set the penalty rate much lower, but it had these so-called frown costs. Don't come to us unless your house is burning down or whatever. And so they'd wait until the rate was high before they'd come borrow from them, right? Mm-hmm. But what now I realize from what you were saying that I was missing, I wasn't thinking of the obvious answer, which is basically what you're doing then is you're just subsidizing banks, right? Because you're saying, borrow from us at one and we'll pay you two, right?
Yeah.
So.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. That's good enough. All right. So on to principle seven, I'm actually like,
sorry, that took me so long to.
No, it's intentionally bizarre question. I'm actually quite encouraged with all that I wrote. I was like, we're going to go like 4 hours or something, but we're doing pretty good.
Doing pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So principle seven. All right. This is a little bit long because.
Yeah. And this is the one that doesn't matter so much anymore too. So.
Oh, all right. Well,
you know, like the, what was the other one we said that, like four.
Four. Yeah. All right. Well, it's still very interesting. So, but I rewrote this. I didn't have time to like kind of get it down because, I got it wrong at first. Okay. Principle seven, in the context of monetary policy, the concept of liquidity effect is that extra reserves in the interbank market pushes down interest rates, which then stimulates banks to make more loans, which in turn increases economic activity. That's the theory. In other words, it's the false view that the interest rate is not something the central bank can arbitrarily decide. Rather, it's something that the central bank can only control or defend by offsetting the effects of market forces. And you know, it's like assuming that the central bank is almost like just a huge currency user. So it has a decent chance of success, but it doesn't have, you know, an infinite capacity to create. That's kind of what it's implying. All right. So specifically, the liquidity effect is the false belief that the only way for the central bank to choose or defend its target rate is to inject a potentially vast amount of reserves into banks' balances. This will encourage banks to increase lending, which in turn will increase economic activity. This is called, when you hear easing, what do they call it? Monetary easing, whatever they call it.
Quantity.
Easing.
Yeah.
And QE is just a,
well, easing, monetary easing, as opposed to tightening.
And then quantitative
easing is just a ridiculous amount of easing. So, and then conversely, removing a large amount called tightening will discourage lending and economic activity. This is the false thing.
Right.
In reality, the target rate is an arbitrary decision, which the term I learned from your paper is a policy variable of the voting members of the central bank.
Mm-hmm.
The consolidated government has the infinite capacity to create and delete its own money and to sell and purchase its own bonds, which means it can effectively choose an interest rate for any bond at any maturity. Okay. The false liquidity preference view also asserts the mere existence of more reserves in a bank account of a bank's account makes banks suddenly need them and makes them even want to use them. And it strongly suggests that reserves, number one, can be directly lent to customers, or that at least can be used for some purpose beyond just settlement and meeting reserve requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So at a personal level, if our banks dramatically increased our personal checking account, then, you know, we'd pay off our mortgage and we'd fix our house and upgrade our house and whatever, you know, because money for us in our bank account and our checking account can be used for a ton of different things. But beyond reserve requirements, the only possible use of bank reserves is to settle transactions. Transactions that have happened at some point in the past, which means that the mere existence of more reserves has no direct influence on a bank's behavior. In other words, settlement, and therefore the amount of reserves needed, is endogenous. A bank's demand for reserves is vertical. Well, how much they need is decided on not by the government, but by actual people choosing to take out a loan and then a bank choosing to give them one. And a final point I wanted to make is that the false idea of liquidity effect, that the mere existence of new reserves incentivizes banks to issue more loans, evokes the concept of Say's Law, which, as I understand it, Say's Law is the false idea that supply causes demand. As if a company just creates a new product and puts it on their shelf, and somehow that magically attracts a customer into the store to buy that product, even though they didn't even know it existed at first. And it all implies that basically powerful people are puppeteers and powerless people are puppets. Like, the consumers are unthinking and the businesses are the only ones that control them. And same with like the central bank and banks. So in reality, demand causes supply. In reality, loans create deposits. Those deposits will at some point likely result in some transactions with another bank, which the bank will need to settle.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't have enough in reserves, only then will they, you know, go to the central bank and request more. So, so liquidity effect, that was a lot. So, all right, go for it.
Yeah, I think mine was actually shorter. That's kind of fun. Okay, so you got to the same place that I finished at, right? That the core idea I was making here is that the demand for reserves is essentially vertical because your need to settle payments on any given day creates a vertical demand curve. You only need that many reserves to do those payments. You don't need more. You don't need less. Same with reserve requirements. You don't need more than what you need to meet your reserve requirements, and you don't need less. And so there's the central bank to change its target rate. And notice what I'm doing here is I'm talking about changing the target rate, not defending it. There are some people in the literature that do interpret it that way. And I'm not interpreting it that way because that one is, that would be its own paper. And I think I get into semantics if I tried to go that direction. So I was talking about changing the rate, that if we decide our target rate was 2, now it's 1. My point is they did not add any reserves to do that because banks couldn't do anything with more reserves. Now, what they might do sometimes prior to 94, because the Fed only started announcing the target rate in 94, prior to 94, they might add some, but that wasn't for liquidity effect. It was to send the signal that we're cutting the rate. And then once the rate had gotten to about what they wanted, they would subtract the reserves. So Yeah. Okay. So one point in there, you said, and you might have just been thinking about something else, but somewhere in there you said liquidity premium. And,
oh, I didn't mean that. No.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I figured.
Liquidity preference. That's what I said.
Yeah, liquidity preference.
It's,
right.
It's liquidity effect, right?
Liquidity that's effect, what it is? Right? Yeah. Liquidity preference is Keynes on. Yeah, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah, no, a liquidity effect. That was just
for anybody listening, I wanted to clarify that one.
Yeah, I did this in a rush because
you got a lot of stuff.
This that particular one section, kinda, this section, I mean, yeah,
that one kind of got you going. The one thing in there that you were doing is you were saying if my bank gives me money, et cetera, et cetera. We have to be careful there and recognize that. What you were talking about there was money in the sense of income, right? And reserves are never really in that way. At least the quantity the Fed is putting out there is never done in a way that's creating income, unless the Fed's paying interest on its reserve. The interest would be income. But, you know, the Fed the Fed is either lending it or it is doing an asset swap, right?
Oh, that's what you mean.
And or it's the treasury spending, right? And putting it out there.
Oh, yeah,
And so it's not the same thing as income for the bank.
Yeah, okay. So marking up my account as a net financial asset, which is just is just completely different than giving reserves, which is always a trade. Yeah, so
okay, yeah, you nailed it. Yeah, that's perfect.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Okay. Do you want to talk about Say's Law?
Oh boy. Well, okay, so yeah, the context here is that even though the liquidity effect isn't something we talk about much anymore now because it's so obvious with countries running, central banks running floor systems and corridors and such that they can, you know, that all they do is just announce a new set of interest rates, a new interest on reserves, a new penalty rate, right? And they pretty much just shifted where the interest rate target's going to be just by announcement, right? So it's much more obvious now that that's what happens.
And if I may, when they do the announcement, it's really backed by that they're going to do it. We have faith
that's when the Fed meets and the FOMC meets and they vote and they, you know, we decided today to raise the interest rate 75 basis points. That's what that is. They do that by raising penalty rate, raising interest on reserves, raising the overnight RRP rate, et cetera. And so they're basically shifting that whole corridor up that they have. And they're running a floor system, but they've still got the other rates there. Mm-hmm. The significance of this one really is about, for today, I guess I would say, since so many central banks have changed their operations, is for endogenous money, right? So it's kind of like what you were saying. If the liquidity effect was assuming that if you put more reserves out there, that they will, the banks will lend them, you know, and the interest rates will fall, et cetera, et cetera. And it's ignoring that the banks don't choose to make loans just because they have reserves. First off, banks would only make those loans to each other in the federal funds market. It's not like you and me going into the bank and the bank's like, hey, we just got more reserves today. What do you think?
But this,
you
know, this,
not the way it works.
This seems to me to imply that making loans to customers.
Yeah. Well,
the liquidity effect seems to imply, the theory seems to imply.
I think you're right. And I think if somebody is only talking about making loans to other banks, then that's less problematic, but they're still running into the problem of a vertical demand curve, right? So, I mean, basically what happens is if the central bank increased operations because it changed its target, it lowered its target, what would happen is the rate would fall to zero or interest on reserves, not that it would fall to the new target, because if the demand curve is basically vertical and the demand curve hasn't moved, if you shift the supply curve, what have you just done, right? You're not hitting the new target rate. You're way below it. So the point was to be in the endogenous money framework and say, the banks do not need the reserves to make those loans to customers and such, et cetera. And if you give them any more, then what's going to happen is they'll have these reserves and they'll try and lend them to each other in the federal funds market. And there's not going to be another bank that wants them, right? Because, no, I already have the reserves I need. So you just have some excess supply of reserves and the rate falls to zero or to interest on reserves. You didn't just cut your interest rate target from 2.5 to 2. That's not how you do it.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I'm choosing to take pride in the fact that my Principle 7 summary is longer than the original Principle 7. So I'm going to choose to be proud of that.
I think that's good. Yeah.
All right. Good. all right. Principle 8. Mm-hmm. The quantity of reserve balances in circulation is primarily determined by the central bank's method of interest rate management. The only uses for reserves are to settle payments and to meet reserve requirements. Mm-hmm. If there are no reserve requirements, then clearly there's less reasons to hold reserves. So right. A simple example, if the central bank chooses to penalize overdrafts severely at the end of each day, then banks are clearly going to demand a lot more reserves in order to prevent that.
Right.
If there were no reserve requirements and both IOR and the penalty rate and the target, obviously, were set to zero, then it seems that there would be little to no uncertainty for banks. It would always be free to purchase reserves from the discount window without penalty whenever they want to. And that seems at least close to MMT ZERP. If all three were equal but set above zero, then banks would make a profit on their reserves. And whenever they want more, then they would just pay that same amount at the discount window. And there would be hardly any need for banks to transact with each other because they could just always go to the central bank for no penalty. So again, it seems that there would be little uncertainty in this scenario. The only difference would be that they would have risk-free and effort-free interest income. So those are two examples of some methods that they can choose to maintain the interest rate. So I don't know, can you just like give a couple other interesting examples and their practical differences between, of those two, and maybe fit in ZERP somehow in there.
Okay. So again, I kind of start with Canada, right? And I say, okay, what is their method of interest rate maintenance? They're trying to hit an interest rate target in the middle of a corridor. They have no reserve requirements. So right off the bat, you're going to have the demand curve only related to payments. And that's fewer reserves than with reserve requirements. But then you've also created, because of the ability to offset everything on the balance sheet and open up trading at the end of the day, you've created complete certainty that you will not have any penalties for your overdrafts at the end of the day, that you'll not be left at the end of the day after that special trading session with an overdraft. So in that system, they could have zero reserve balances held overnight. If you have more uncertainty about being able to clear it by the end of the day, even without reserve requirements, you're going to want to hold some reserves overnight because, you know, as a buffer, basically, against going negative overnight. If you have reserve requirements, it's going to raise it a little bit more, et cetera. So the point kind of was, again, the quantity of reserve balances was really about what the Fed wanted to do, not what banks wanted to do. Meaning, if you see banks have $20 billion or $50 billion, that's because the Fed set up a system that would end up with about $20 billion or end up with about $50 billion, not because banks were like, we want $30 billion more. And this is particularly about, again, endogenous money versus, you know, money multiplier or fractional reserve banking, where it would be, oh, banks wanted more so they could make more loans, right? Well, no, they don't do that. Making more loans doesn't mean they need more reserves, right? Mm-hmm. It only means you might have more reserve requirements, but again, that also depends on how certain you are of being able to meet them. because the more certain you are that you can meet the reserve requirements, the less excess reserves you're going to want to hold. So now the one thing that this is leaving out, I'd have to look through the rest of it, but I don't know if I talked about a floor system here, because the exception would be a floor system.
Exception.
Or maybe it's I do have it there.
Exception to what?
I do have it there on page, what is it? The exception to what I've got in this chat, in this principle, but page 72, the move by banks to reduce blah, 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 blah. Where is it? Boy, that is a long paragraph. I do not write like that anymore. That's really bad style. Anyway, I had a different writing style.
You were
style,
inspired by my summary of Principle 7.
You know, let's see. Oh, a target rate of interest set equal to the rate of interest paid on reserve balances as proposed in Principle 6. So that means a floor system. So I covered that a bit in Principle 6. In fact,
when the target is equal to IOR, that's by definition a floor system?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because you're setting the interest rate at the floor of the corridor.
Okay.
Right. So basically, you're setting the interest rate at the horizontal portion of a demand curve rather than the downward sloping part. Right. So and the horizontal portion of the demand curve would be the floor, right? The price floor.
Okay.
So once you do that though, now the only way you get to the floor is by increasing the quantity beyond the demand curve's downward sloping portion. Right. And then you have that whole space to the right of the downward sloping portion of the demand curve. You have, you know, up to, I don't know, logically up to infinity. So we've seen the Fed be anywhere between, I don't know, $1.5 trillion in reserves in say 2019 to over $4 trillion a few years ago. And now they're down, I think they're closer to between $2 and $3 trillion now, but every single one of those is basically just somewhere in that floor, in that horizontal part of the demand curve. So they can directly target, and it's not related to the method of interest rate maintenance if you're running a floor system, as long as you are to the right of the downward sloping part of the demand curve.
Okay.
Because then you've got more than enough out there for them to settle payments and meet reserve requirements.
Okay. All right. Great. Mm-hmm. All right. So principle 9, under current operating procedures, the central bank's balance sheet expands and contracts endogenously, while these changes neither create nor destroy net financial assets for the non-government sector. I mean, that's kind of, you know, reserves are only in the banking system. They're not, lent out to. All right.
Kind of a precursor to the quantitative easing kind of stuff, right? Where people like to think of quantitative easing as, you know, just dropping money from a helicopter. And the point was, no, quantitative easing is an asset swap. Dropping money from a helicopter is basically like a government deficit, because that creates net financial assets. And so that's kind of where I was going there. This was really a way of going at monetarism to say, to kind of talk about how they're being sloppy with what money is. They've got a few different definitions going at the same time. And they're talking about money as if it is a net financial asset when it's not.
Reserves are net financial.
Yeah. Oh. They're talking about, reserves and they're talking about reserves essentially as if they're I'll say it a different way. They're talking about the central bank's operations to manage the interest rate target, or even on a floor system to, you know, increase reserves. They're talking about them as if they create net financial assets. So that was where I was going. Mm-hmm. This is something that became a much bigger deal after 2009, of course. And so this is one that I wouldn't have invoked some of the things that I did if I were writing it today. But back then, you still had, this was written for the debates that had been going on at the time, if that makes sense. Yeah.
All right. So, so there was one sentence in that section that that I'd like you to clarify, which is, you say, neither reserve balances nor the monetary base can be expanded or contracted exogenously by the central bank as long as the central bank's target rate is above the floor, is above the rate paid on reserve balances. So can you clarify that?
Sure. If you were setting an interest rate above the floor, above interest on reserves, if that's your target, if you want to hit a target above the floor, then you have to basically hit the demand curve where it is above the floor. So the central bank can't just decide, I want to increase by this amount, or I want to decrease reserves by this amount, if they're trying to hit an interest rate above the floor. If they're trying to hit an interest rate above the floor, there's one quantity that will hit it, and that's the amount that banks demand at that interest rate.
Mm. Okay, easy enough. All right.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Mm-hmm. All right, so principle 10, final principle.
That was quick. All right. Very good.
This principle, I mean, what they're basically doing in this principle is just distinguishing between a currency issuer and a currency user. That's what it seems like.
And yes.
So you say central bank.
I was careful because I didn't, there was some charged language that I could have used if I'd gone overly chartalist here. Mm-hmm. And so I was being kind of, I don't know, politically not trying to ruffle any, how would I say it?
Nudge people who were against chartalism, a step towards chartalism.
Well, I mean, I was making it basically so it would cover both chartalists, as we called ourselves back then, and horizontalists, even though there are some differences on the points in principle 10. So that's the word I'm looking for. I was a bit more broad on explaining this point so that I could incorporate horizontalist and chartalist views into this one. Okay. Because there would have been some differences, and they're technical. We don't need to worry about it really.
Okay. All right. So central bank interest rates matter because banks use reserves to pay, to settle payments. Yeah. So banks and market forces don't control the interest rate.
Right.
For the simple fact that banks must settle their transactions at the end of each day. Those transactions can only be settled with reserves, and those reserves can only be supplied, created, and deleted by the central bank. Also, there's no use for reserves beyond settlement and reserve requirements. Mm-hmm. Settling payments with anything other than risk-free reserves, like the banks doing their own side deals of setting, you know, settling stuff on, that is obviously riskier than settling them with risk-free reserves. Reserves mm-hmm. are also the only thing that can settle tax obligations to the state, mm-hmm. which can only be done through the banking system. Mm-hmm. Like I was thinking of like, well, what if I send a check to the Treasury, directly to the Treasury? Well, obviously that bank is, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to be contacting my bank. Mm-hmm. And banks are legal extensions, franchises of the state. If they try mm-hmm. to bypass the state entirely and the central bank by, like you were talking about how a few economists were like, well, banks can just completely settle everything by themselves. They don't even need the central bank anymore. Mm-hmm. The government's not going to take that lying down. They're not going to let that happen because at the very least, reserves are what the government can use to keep track of the bank's behaviors. Mm-hmm. So the banks don't control the central bank and its interest rate any more than an average person controls their commercial banks just because they have a deposit there. So, and
that's
you know,
interesting it, analogy.
In you know, even the richest person, like there's a saying that you know, if you have $100 in the bank, then the bank controls you. But if you have $1 billion in the bank, then you control the bank. But that's only because the bank allows you to do that. So even the most powerful currency user has no power over the currency issuer because their power largely comes from the issuer. And because they were issued a lot and other people were issued less. And any power the user has over the issuer is only because the issuer chooses it to be that way. So that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's from the MMT or charterless position, this is really saying, what are the implications of the fact that you need the government's money to pay taxes? What are the implications for interest rates, right? And so it's basically saying, if reserves are the government's money, that's really fundamentally, that's the money of charterism in the real world, is central bank reserves, because that's what pays taxes. That's what settles taxes. So if everybody has to get them to pay taxes, or at least all the banks do, then the interest rate on them, which is how you get them, matters. That basically sets the anchor, if you will, for other interest rates, right? Everything else will be priced off of that. There's no purely free market rate of interest that's being set anywhere in the economy, unless you're off in prison or something talking about borrowing and lending cigarettes, you know, whatever. as long as you're in the real world economy and you know, our financial system, there's an anchor to this, and it's the central bank's target rate, and everything else will get priced off of it. And there's no free market beyond that. It's a monopoly price setter, as Warren Mosler likes to say. But here the price is that core interest rate of our financial system, that starting point of the bank's cost of funds. And that is a policy variable. That's not something that there's a market that's setting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I'm glad we didn't, we don't want to talk about this, but the very last paragraph of that principle is kind of cringy for me. I don't know if I agree with any of that.
Really?
I have to look carefully.
The very last, in front of me. I'm curious.
Yeah, but the very last paragraph of that, I was trying to again be a bit politically inclusive there, and I, looking at it now, I don't know that I pulled it off. Just say it that way. I up to that point, I was pulling it off in that section. I mean, if I'm looking at this, I like, one of my favorite parts here is going through. And I won't discuss it here because it's really technical, but there's a discussion of this guy at the St. Louis Fed named Thornton. I think it was Daniel. He had done some research, published some stuff, well-known guy, monetarist. St. Louis Fed, pre-2000, I don't know exactly, 2008, 2009, something like that. St. Louis Fed was all monetarist, basically, prior to that. And they still have quite a few of them. So what Thornton was trying to argue is that the Fed changed its interest rate target based on what it saw treasuries doing. And so it was really the traders in the treasury market, they were the free markets setting rates, and the Fed was following them. And so that was part of the point of this, was to say, no, that's not how it's working. That, you might statistically find that one of them is leading the other, but we know from the way the operations work that this is what's happening. And there were some problems with the statistics because he basically ignored the payment system fluctuations in the interest rate to get the results he had, which made it so that he'd left out everything that could possibly pull the rug out from underneath his argument. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, if I assume everything away that isn't supporting my argument, then my argument looks pretty good.
Yeah. I had an argument on Twitter with some guy, and I had a source that completely showed, like primary source showed that he was completely wrong. And then he says, oh, you're just going to appeal to authority? You can't just tell me what you're thinking? Like, okay. All right.
Wow. I thought that was what you did with scholarship, is especially on these kind of things, right? It's like, yeah. How do you know that somebody behaves, that banks have to behave a certain way? You go to the, yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
All
right. So anything else about the paper before I'm done with the paper? I have a couple of unrelated.
Go to the next stuff.
Okay. All right. So a final, just kind of, I'm curious. I just would like to know what you think. Who would you appoint to the various economic and financial positions? And I'm curious what you would want to do. And if that happened, what would be like a couple of examples of like the major things that would happen?
You're just talking about any kind of economic policy or
Treasury Secretary, FOMC board, whatever.
Well, I mean, ideally, of course, I would put my friends in to those positions.
Name names.
My colleagues, right? I mean, you got, I don't know, put Stephanie on the Fed or the Treasury, put, I don't know, Pavlina in head of the, you know, make Pavlina Labor Secretary, you know, put Rowan on the Supreme Court, you know, and Nathan, I got to give Nathan a good job. Well, whichever one Stephanie doesn't get, I'll give to Nathan.
Okay. What about Treasury Secretary?
Between Treasury and the Fed, feels like I'm playing cops and robbers in the backyard and just picking things up. But
what would Warren be? What would you?
Warren? Yeah, I mean, same sort of stuff. I don't know. I guess I just stack up all on the Fed. I don't know. The nice thing about the Fed is you get 14-year terms.
Hmm.
Well, assuming you get, depending on when you come in,
gave Rowan a lifetime term. So,
yeah, I did. Yeah, that would be good. I expect something in return for that, though. No, I don't. Yeah, I'm sure I'm leaving people out too, because
really
smart people.
Aside from this, you know, obviously, you know, good people will be there. But like, what would be like some of the immediate, obvious changes that would happen? Just a few small examples.
Obviously. It's not something you change overnight, but the first thing that we would want to start working on would be a job guarantee for sure, because a job guarantee replaces involuntary unemployment. It doesn't replace any other policy. That's something that people don't understand.
Right.
It doesn't anything.
It doesn't do everything. So
your favorite policy, everybody's favorite policy, is not competing with the job guarantee. That's something people don't understand. Because if you have your favorite policy and you don't want a job guarantee, what you're saying is it's your favorite policy plus unemployment for whoever doesn't get employed.
Mm-hmm.
And all we're saying is your favorite policy plus a job guarantee instead of unemployment.
Okay. Because, you know, monetary policy, example of what would change as far as monetary policy, maybe so like what design you would choose or whatever.
Yeah. Monetary policy would be about using macroprudential regulation and various tools like that, and not using the short-term interest rate. We would set the short-term interest rate low. I don't know if zero, but you know, low.
Closed.
And leave it there. That doesn't mean we don't believe in monetary policy. We don't want monetary policy doing anything. We think monetary policy should be very active in managing credit conditions. It doesn't mean we don't think monetary policy should manage any of the other interest rates in the economy. Because the issue is the Fed is changing that short-term interest rate. And it's hoping then that the Treasury markets move in kind, and then the corporate bond markets move in kind, and the mortgage rate markets move in kind, and the commercial loan markets move in kind, right? And what we're saying is go directly to those other rates. Don't have this huge transition through those things. If you think there's a housing bubble in San Francisco, go raise the interest rate on certain mortgages in San Francisco.
Sure.
Right? Go raise the minimum lending terms for loans in San Francisco on particular things, right? That's where we're going with it. And it's because you get problems like we're having right now. And you mentioned it actually early on. You raise the interest rate like this and this fast, it's not just the U.S. economy you're messing up. You are messing with the whole world right now.
Yeah. And, well, I just came to that realization recently.
They're just playing with fire. Well, the last time we did this, the same thing happened, just worse, at least as of now, right? When Volcker did his thing, that's when you had the Latin American debt crisis. And that's why, right? All these folks had borrowed in dollars and the interest and such. And now we're in a situation where even if they haven't borrowed in dollars, they might be vulnerable to importing inflation if their currencies depreciate. So now the Fed's raising rates and they got to raise rates with the Fed to keep their currency from depreciating too much.
Mm.
And so when they do that, maybe their economy wasn't ready for higher interest rates, right? Maybe they're, and that's Japan. There was an article on Japan today in the New York Times, actually, and quote, a couple of quotes, nice quotes from Bill Mitchell, actually, on Japan, that, you know, Japan's currency is depreciated to a 30, 32, I can't remember, year low against the dollar. And Japan Central Bank, Bank of Japan, at least for now, has chosen not to raise interest rates because they're saying our economy doesn't, we really don't want higher interest rates in our economy right now. It's not ready for it. Mm-hmm. And so basically they're having this hope that they can withstand the currency depreciation that's going on at the same time, that at some point they don't start importing inflation.
Okay.
And this is the whole thing about monetary sovereignty that we talk about, right? That we tended to talk about, don't borrow in a foreign currency, have a flexible exchange rate. And times like this, we start to see the nuance to that position, because can you allow your exchange rate to depreciate so much without having negative repercussions, importing inflation being, you know, the main one, but you might have a private sector that's been borrowing in dollars. Mm-hmm. So various things like that. So there's a lot of nuance to this, because Japan might be able to handle its exchange rate depreciating 30% without much consequence, but Indonesia can't, you know.
Mm. Wow. Well, just a brief follow-up. So you said, you know, setting it to zero or close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
What about the target rate and the discount, the penalty rate? What would those be in that?
The penalty rate would be a little bit above
very
the target rate, and the interest on reserve would be a little bit below. Yeah. I'd probably run a floor system. There's a few regulations I'd get rid of, because we've created a really bad situation in treasury markets with the post Great Recession financial regulations. It was well-intentioned. It was trying to get banks to have a lot more liquid assets on hand, and relative to stuff that could, liabilities that could be coming due, and also to have a lot more capital. The problem was the way that they did it turned the U.S. Treasury market from the safe haven in a crisis to just another market in a crisis that also goes in a crisis. Because they've essentially said in a crisis, the regulations post Great Recession now say essentially in a crisis, don't buy treasuries the same way you wouldn't buy other things. And so then we're surprised that the Fed has to jump in to the treasury market, you know, and everybody's like, well, the market's rejecting the treasuries because the deficit's too big. No, you wrote regulations that basically said, don't buy treasuries. So then you're surprised they're not buying them. And that's also what happened to the Bank of England, or in the UK, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had some similar problems where if they were on the pre 2008-2009 regulatory system, I would doubt that the Bank of England would have had to do anything in their government bond market.
Wow,
because it was the safe place to go always, and so that's where the money all went. And so if you got some issue like they had with the currency depreciating, you wouldn't see it necessarily come into the bond markets too. So.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, awesome. That's everything. I am excited to your Okay, so I was in blah, blah, blah. Let me start that again. I was assigned your paper by my first Torrens course, which is Introduction to MMT, basically high speed. So you are going to be teaching macroeconomics. When does that start? Next semester? Next trimester?
It's like mid-February, something like that.
Okay, because I'm actually surprised, because I thought, are there no prerequisites at all for your class then?
I don't know if there are or not. I thought that
there were two
there's
core two classes, but I guess it doesn't mean prerequisite. It just means you have to take them at some point. That's what so
I think they should be prerequisites if they ask me, but because I'm kind of going on the assumption that people have taken those classes, because I don't have time to ground all of the stuff you're doing now and the stuff that I'm planning to do.
So it's interesting because, I was planning on taking the other course thinking it was a prerequisite before taking yours, but you're teaching it next semester. So anyway, I'm not sure.
I guess I'll probably be teaching it the semester after that too, I think. So if you were to do the other class, as a prerequisite, before.
Well, I'm kind of anxious. If it's not a prerequisite, I'm kind of anxious to do it. But anyway, how close are you to finishing your, whatever you call it, design or whatever it is?
Well, they have a whole detailed process that you go through. It's very well organized and super nice people. So basically the milestones they've set, the course has to basically be planned by the end of November, aside from the video lectures.
Have you pretty much like been thinking of this has been brewing in your head for years, or
that's a good question. Because I teach some of this stuff anyway already, right? Because I teach the master's and PhD level macro here at UMKC. And I also teach the graduate monetary economics, monetary theory, whatever course. So the course is going to be a blend of those, some things that I do in those courses, but it's also, well, not so much what I do in the PhD course, because that's different stuff, we'll just say. it's not all MMT in that class. So, gosh, what was I going to say? I forgot. It's fun because it does allow me to kind of, you kind of get into a routine with your courses as you design them each semester. And I do try and change a bit of my classes every semester. And, there's a general rule in academics that you don't change much more than 10% of your class any semester, because you end up with, it's too much work. You end up, just thrown off. And it's true. I've tried to do more than 10%. And every time I do, I end up regretting it. But this was an opportunity to change more and to put things together that I don't always have together. And I even brought in some of my stuff from my own advisor because of the sustainability angle. So I was able to bring in, that's an angle that I don't always get to put in. So I'm enjoying it. I'm about halfway through right now. I've written the assignments and I've got, I'm almost 12 weeks. I'm on the fifth week of planning now.
Wow. That's great.
My experience with Torrens has been very good so far.
Okay. Thank you so much for this whole experience. Not just talking with you, but the email and everything. And it was great.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah.
Yeah.
And do it again if you want. No worries.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
See you later.
Okay. Yeah. Take care. Bye-bye.
Music for this show is by Rec Tech. You can find Rec Tech on SoundCloud and Spotify at WREC_T. M-M-T-E-C-H. To record Activist MMT, I use the iOS phone app Tape a Call Plus for recording phone calls and Zencastr for internet-based recordings. My post-production workflow starts by editing on the iOS app AnyTune Pro Plus, then transferring those timestamps to my Windows desktop. At that point, I crudely process the audio in Audacity and then implement the edits and do all the final processing in the Reaper digital audio workstation. Activist MMT is hosted by Libsyn, and the video teasers are created with the online Headliner app. Today is the final part of my three-part conversation with Scott Fulweiler on his 2008 paper, Modern Central Bank Operations, The General Principles. Today we discuss principles 7 through 10. My full and detailed question and summary list can be found in the show notes to part 1. Also, be sure to check out the list of audio chapters at the bottom of today's show notes to find precisely where each principle and otherwise can be found. Principle 7, which refers to a world without a floor system, QE being an example of a floor system, is that a central bank can change its target interest rate by simply announcing it. This is contrary to the false idea that the central bank can only set a new target rate by overwhelming the system with reserves in order to push the rate higher, or push it lower by starving the system by selling a very large amount of bonds. This implies the central bank and its government to be little more than a very large currency user. Also, the liquidity effect is the false idea that the mere existence of reserves makes banks want more of them, and that this in turn results in more lending to its customers. This is essentially Say's law, which is the false idea that supply causes demand. Principle 8 is that the amount of total reserves in the system is primarily due to the central bank's method of interest rate management. If a central bank chooses a floor system like QE, then there will be a whole lot of reserves in the system. If they also choose restrictive reserve requirements, then there will be even more, as banks demand more in order to meet those requirements. If there was no floor system or reserve requirements, then the total amount in the system will be greatly reduced. In this case, once again, the aggregate level will be controlled by the rigidness of banks needing to settle payments each day, which is primarily dependent on the behavior of actual humans in the real economy, which is the non-government sector. Principles 9 and 10 basically assert that the central bank is in the unique position of being a currency issuer. Only the central bank, via the execution of fiscal policy, can create net financial assets, which is money we don't have to pay back. Commercial banks can only create credit, which must always be paid back, plus interest. Commercial banks, and indeed the entire financial system and economy, depends on the central bank because we have to pay taxes, which can ultimately only be paid with reserves, which can only be done through the banking system. Also, banks are legal franchises of the state. If a commercial bank tried to bypass the central banking system entirely, it wouldn't be a bank for long. In the same way, you could try and call yourself a bank, but unless you're legally sanctioned and accepted as one by the central bank, you're not going to get very far. You can financially support this podcast by going to patreon.com/activistmmt. For as little as $1 a month, all patrons get exclusive super early access to several full episodes and some unique patron-only opportunities like asking my academic guests questions, like my episodes with Dirk Entz, John Harvey, and Warren Mosler. In addition to this podcast, patrons also support the development of my large and growing collection of LearnMMT resources and my journey through the Torrens graduate program. To become a patron, you can start by going to patreon.com/activistmmt. Every little bit helps a little bit, and it all adds up to a lot. Thanks. And now, let's get right back to my conversation with Scott Fulweiler. Enjoy.